This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 266, where CJ and AC are back again, talking about some of the latest news in the cloud around Microsoft and Google Cloud Platform, and just catching up after not seeing each other for, seems like, about a year. Recorded live August the 10th, 2018.
A 99.9% SLA means you're protected from power outages, bad patches, natural disasters, maybe even a dinosaur attack. Does it protect you from yourself, though? AvePoint Backup for SharePoint Online provides full fidelity backup and recovery from individual items to entire team sites. AvePoint can run backups up to 4 times a day to ensure your data is secure. Recover anytime you want without having to pick up the phone and schedule restore windows. Learn why AvePoint is the Microsoft Cloud expert at www.avpoint.com.
Hi, CJ. My name is Andrew Connell. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, pleasure to meet you. What happened to the last guy?
I don't know. I haven't seen him in a couple. Oh wait, you look kind of familiar.
I heard some like really awful rumor, like that he died of some sort of like disease, like some sort of transmitted disease that gets transferred by remote Zoom meetings.
You're gonna get me in trouble here. Yeah, it's funny. Man, it's been God. It feels like it's been Jesus, like almost a month since we've sat down to record together.
Yeah. I guess. Kind of apologies to listeners. Last week we skipped a week, which doesn't happen very often, or hasn't happened very often in our history, I guess. But sort of events transpired against us, and we couldn't pull it off. So, yeah, apologies for that. But it's really nice to be back sitting here, not face to face, but you know, remotely face to face, and actually, you know, getting a show recorded together. It's kind of novel. I like it.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's been, so let's see. So in the last time we were together and recorded, right after that, you and I both left at about the same time. So you took off and went, you were gone for 3 weeks on vacation with the family. It looked like some family vacation stuff, like seeing family in New Zealand and then...
Yeah, sister's birthday and then family vacation, yeah.
Yeah, so you were gone for 3 weeks in the Pacific and I was gone... working and vacationing. I went to Canada to teach a private onsite of my class. I have to apologize for episode, I think it was 264, where I might have sounded like I was drunk. I wasn't. I was just really tired because I recorded at the end of the week.
Keep up the story, dude.
Yeah, exactly. And then the next week I was on vacation with my family and my in-laws. And then the week after that, I was at a dev kitchen in Seattle for some stuff. And then we were supposed to get, and that's the one when you recorded solo 265.
Yeah.
We were supposed to record last week. And like you said, I got home very late on Thursday night. You got home on, was it Thursday night?
As well. Yeah. Yep.
Okay. So you got home on Thursday night from being in the Pacific. And then Friday, we're both like,
Dude, I was so sick. I was like, I caught some bug on the plane on the way back. And I felt like, death warmed up. It was terrible. Hey, but this is like, I mean, I don't want to start with the analogies too much, but this is like getting back together with an old girlfriend. There's like sort of, there's this level of comfort and sort of familiarity that you're used to, but it's like somebody new.
Yeah, but to be clear, there's no benefit.
just let's get that, yeah, let's get that straight up. Straight. Yeah. Hold on. That's not the right word either.
Moving right along.
Anyway.
So what you been up to, man?
Oh, dude. Yeah, really catching up since I've been away. Obviously, work doesn't go away when you're away. So, you know, I was doing things while I was away, obviously. But, you know, there's a big pile of stuff you get, you know, when you come back. So trying to catch up on a bunch of those things and get back into the swing of it and catch, you know, basically start digging through a pile of things that built up while I was away. So I feel kind of a bit more on top of that now and back into the general flow of stuff. But man, oh man, summer here has been absolutely staggeringly nice so far. And so it's been kind of hard to not want to, you know, go for long walks for meetings. Let's put it that way. Yeah. And so taking meetings outside and walking and stuff. But dude, last night it was 95 Fahrenheit or freedom units, which is about like 30... I think 32 Celsius, something like that, at 6 o'clock at night. And so for Seattleites, that's a big deal. Like it's been hot here. You're like critic, like 95. You know. Yeah.
Everybody in, I get,
Everybody in Texas is like, Texas, like I set my aircon to 95. Yeah. Yeah, but it's been pretty roasty here. So I'm trying to enjoy a bit of summer back now. Now we're home and trying to get back into the swing of productivity. How about you?
Yeah, it was. We've been dealing with the same heat. I think it was yesterday. Was it yesterday? Yeah, yesterday. I think I was on my way home from lunch with meeting up with some buddies that I hadn't seen in a while. And the car said it was 102 outside Fahrenheit. So get this. So I can relate to the whole heat thing, not just from the fact that it was hot, but two nights ago, I think, we had like a really violent lightning storm in the area. We had two lightning strikes that were within about 2/10 of our house, maybe a little bit closer. And we had all of a sudden, like we lost power for a second, it came back, and then we had another one that hit like right after that. And I thought it might have screwed some stuff up in the house. All of a sudden, about an hour later, I start noticing, hey, the upstairs is getting kind of warm. Like, oh, you have got to be kidding me. Please don't tell me this thing just knocked out our air conditioner. And our house is built in a way that, like a classic contractor spec house. So it was very inefficient. And it has three air conditioners, two big ones, and then one tiny one that runs just like two rooms, just for the way the house is laid out. Two of the three were not pumping. They said they were cooling the house, but man, you walk up to it and you're like, that feels like a hairdryer.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Oh my God. I'm just like, this is the last thing I need is to go be told that, you know, you've got to drop 10 grand to get an air conditioner.
AC unit. Oh, brutal.
Thankfully they came back, but man, talk about pucker factor. My wife's like, why are you coming out from the office? Like just, you know, in a really grumpy mood. And at dinner, you're not really talking. And I'm just sitting there like, no reason. Why is it cold in the kitchen? I'm like, because that's the only air conditioner that's cooling the house right now. I'm trying to get it going right now. I wasn't saying any of this. And then about an hour later, when I figured it all out, I looked at her, I wasn't going to tell you that I thought we had lost two air conditioners. Her eyes got real big. Like, we don't want to spend that kind of money. I'm like, I know. Yep. That's why I didn't say anything.
Ouch. Surprising there isn't like air conditioner insurance for places like that. Anyway.
Oh, man. It's, I don't know, whatever. We have this thing on our house that's supposed to protect it, where if we get a lightning strike, we have these, it's kind of like a fuse protector, a fuse box on the fuse box. So it catches a surge within 2 nanoseconds of it hitting the house, and it blows one fuse in the house. We have two fuse boxes. And so we know that if the oven doesn't turn on or if the dryer doesn't turn on, then it blew those two fuses, but it kept the surge from coming into the house. So
blowing up everything else.
Yeah,
interesting.
Exactly.
Interesting. Yeah, I've got an uncle who had a lightning strike in it, and it, blew a box off a wall. Yeah, anyway.
Fun stuff.
Crazy. Electricity, yeah. Who needs it?
Yeah, exactly.
So what have we got on the cards today?
We got some news. We figured, why don't we just catch up on some news and all that stuff? But before we do that, why don't we first hear from one of our esteemed sponsors?
Are you being asked repeatedly to integrate different business systems in ever narrower timeframes with increasing process complexity? What if you could standardize the way you build these business processes so your team are focused on higher value tasks versus the nuts and bolts of running the processes and integrations? Nintex can make that happen. With the Nintex platform, work flows from person to person, system to system, to the cloud and back. Got a custom system you want to connect with? No-code extensions let you plug into systems simply and easily using REST and Swagger. With Nintex, work just flows, so your teams can work smarter, work faster, and be more connected than ever. Try it out for free for 30 days at www.nintex.com/trynwc.
All right, so CJ, we got a couple different things here. Listen, we got some Microsoft general news, we've got some Azure news, we got some Azure news around specific features, and we got one little bit on the Google Cloud Platform. So why don't you give us, why don't you kind of run through some of this Azure news that we have here for our listeners, talking about, oh man, looks like we got some financial stuff here that's kind of going to be kind of interesting.
Yeah, I guess kicking things off, it's not often that the Wall Street Journal, for example, has good news about Microsoft, right? And in particular, the press in general, especially on the financial side. But the Wall Street Journal did an article last week, I think it was the 2nd of August, and I bookmarked it, and it's called Microsoft Narrows Gap with Amazon in Cloud. And it's based off the news that I covered in my solo show about some of Microsoft's financials a while back and the end of financial year and things. But in a nutshell, it goes through and basically says, does some analysis over the market share of the main cloud providers. And it basically says that Amazon's AWS's market share slipped from 53.7% to 51.8%, and that Microsoft's rose to 13.3% market share from 8.7% a year prior. And so it's trying to do some sort of backwards analysis on who's growing and who's shrinking and who's got the market share and stuff. And honestly, like 13.3% doesn't sound like a lot of market share, but when you consider how hard it is to take share away from somebody once somebody's on a platform, this is pretty great progress if you ask me. And the one thing some people don't realize about Microsoft is they will just be relentless and chip away at AWS's dominance here. At least this is my view. I'm kind of Microsoft biased though, right? So, but I feel like that the march is slow but steady. And I think we should expect to see that 13% hit, you know, 20% over the next 12 to 14 months or something like that. And if not, the surge to increase in pace.
Yeah, I thought there were three stats in that article that I found really interesting or eye-opening there. So they talk about IaaS, and they said that IaaS is now generating $3.1 billion in revenue. So that's just VMs. Now, that's an impressive number, but here's what's really impressive. That's an increase of over 98% from 2016. That's huge.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, the other part that they said too is that Microsoft, this is a report from Microsoft. So they credit growth in their enterprise customers, saying that more than 95% of Fortune 500s have at least one Microsoft Cloud Enterprise service, and over 75% have at least three.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good... Do you remember what year Azure came out? Or I mean, Office 365 is what, about a 2012, 2013 thing?
Yeah, I guess so. 2012, 2013. I mean, it was BPOS before that. There was BPOS like 2008, 2009, I think. Because 2009, it was PDC 2009, where Ray Ozzie stood on stage and talked about Azure as a thing, like called it Azure for the first time. I'm pretty sure it was PDC 2009. Yeah, I want to say.
8 or 9, yeah.
Yeah, I vividly remember it because I was in the SharePoint team at the time and we were standing at the back of the room and he announced that they were going to be doing Azure SharePoint services or something along those lines. And we were all at the back of the room like, what the f*** is that?
Yeah. That was Los Angeles, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I think that was 2008. That was the only PVC I ever attended. Because I remember being in that room. It was like, almost like a Windows SharePoint services in Azure. And we're like, what?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We're like, you and me both, bro. That was the first time SharePoint team had heard of it too.
Oh, no. You're right. It was 2009 because I remember that was the same conference where Ted Paston and I launched Critical Path Trainings. It was in May of 2009.
There you go. I think maybe 2008 was the Office Developer Conference that you and I met for the first time.
That's right.
Do you remember that?
I do remember that. I do remember that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that was in LA as well. Anyway, yes, I do remember when Azure was launched, or Office 365. Yeah, it was a while ago now.
Mm. Very cool.
But yeah, so it's been a large march over the years, but I just found it really interesting that Wall Street Journal are covering this and starting to take notice of their progress and Microsoft's dominance, and not dominance in market share, but in terms of growth, and we'll continue to see that. So, yeah, I thought it was really interesting. Hopefully they keep up this coverage and keep this analysis going. I think Microsoft's on a march for cloud dominance, especially in the enterprise. The only way is up from here in terms of market share as well. So I wouldn't be surprised to see that accelerate. But yeah, interesting bit of news.
Agreed. Definitely agree there.
Speaking of making more money, I got I found this interesting article by a guy called Brendan Sirok, something like that, who it's titled Microsoft Raising Prices on Licenses, Hoping Customers Will Switch to Subscriptions. It's not really riveting stuff, but you don't really hear about much about sort of on-prem license costs. And if anybody's interested, they talk about bumping up prices over the last, you know, wee while to basically try and entice people to go to subscription based revenue as opposed to perpetual licensing for on-premises. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so he covers it. He talks a little bit about quietly releasing some new pricing information on the newest editions of Office and SharePoint and Exchange server editions for 2019. So they're bumping on-prem pricing up about 10% to try and push even more people to the cloud and make the ROI and cost benefit analysis even easier to make a decision to move to the cloud. If it wasn't already, then yeah, if you're on-prem, price is going to go up 10%-ish.
Something like that. Reason moves to subscription. I mean, you know, one side of me hates the subscription model, but one part of me loves it because it's a, you don't have that upfront cost and you just pay for while you're using it. And if you're not using it, you just cancel the sub.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, perpetual and on-prem is still a massive business for Microsoft for those server products, obviously, you know, billions and billions of dollars still. And so, yeah, they'll make a bit of moolah off this and obviously help push people to 365 a bit quicker.
Very cool.
There's one last article kind of around Microsoft general stuff that I thought was really interesting, which is an article up on LinkedIn by this analyst from Zinov. I don't know if I'm saying that firm. Called How Microsoft Went from a Consumer-Focused to an Enterprise-Focused Business. And it just really drills down, like, over the years, how the business internally at Microsoft has been structured and how they've sort of pivoted over the years to being enterprise-first as opposed to sort of, you know, years gone by consumer-first and what that has changed to their business. And then also, you know, kind of how they've focused their product lineup and their business units around the enterprise and how that's translated into how they report revenue and their product lines and all this sort of stuff. And they go so far as doing things like sentiment analysis on the earnings calls and how much they talk about Windows, positive and negative sentiment, what their M&A deals have been like, all those sorts of things, and their investments and all this sort of stuff. Anyway, it's just really kind of interesting tidbits of information that I found fascinating, and I think some of our listeners will as well. So we'll link to that in the show notes, and you can go have a read. But yeah, it was just kind of interesting. They've run all of the earnings calls through an ML model to kind of do analysis on certain mentions and sentiment in the calls about different topics. And just found it really interesting.
This is interesting. I hadn't seen this until you posted this, and it's really cool to see, because they do a good job of like doing a, you know, here's where Satya Nadella was announced as CEO, and you can see how the focus has really changed, or is really emphasized on enterprise. Like, you haven't seen a single consumer acquisition since 2015. And even then, it was less than 20% all acquisitions. So,
yeah. Well, playing to their strengths, right? They've always been quite strong in enterprise, and it's only theirs to lose in the cloud. So, yeah, it's obviously working. They're doing well.
That's true. You can find another Azure link here, too. This is a pretty cool one. I hadn't seen this. This Medium post?
Oh, yeah. So Microsoft have launched a new Medium blog, I guess, for want of a better word. And so they're posting content to medium.com/Microsoft Azure. And it's called Cloud for All. Any language, any platform. Our global team is focused on making the world more amazing for developers and IT operations, communities of all backgrounds. And so it's basically by the open source, like, advocate Azure team. And so they're talking about, they're publishing content about being, you know, doing all your stuff on Azure, even if you're not from a Microsoft background. So for things like Java applications and serverless and what else we got here, Docker and Node stuff, OS X development, Postgres dev stuff, all sorts of different topics.
There's a lot of really good links here.
Yeah, they're going to be posting more and more content to it by the looks of it. So just, you know, another location to go get your content from.
Absolutely, yeah. This is really cool here. Yeah, I also found a handful of links here around Cosmos DB that have come out recently. I'll go through these kind of quick. So one is a bit of news. I like this because I'm more of a TypeScript, so JavaScript guy, server side and client side. And Cosmos DB, they announced the 2.0 of their JavaScript SDK now in public preview. And to kind of piggyback off the back of that, they've announced two other things here, or made available two other things. There was recently like an Azure, or sorry, a Cosmos DB kind of boot campy kind of thing, like a workshop. And you can find all the detail around the labs that were provided in the workshop at cosmosdb.github.io/labs. So there's links. We'll have a link to this in the show notes. It's a cool lab, though, and it kind of walks you through, you know, creating a partition solution using Cosmos DB, another one on working with the SQL API, and then also creating stored procedures using JavaScript, and then troubleshooting and tuning Cosmos DB requests. They even got a lab about, you know, how to clean up your stuff so you're not going to get charged with a bunch of things that are running going in the future.
Nice.
But some some other stuff that they've added too that's available is this one service, this one thing called the Change Feed Lab. This is cool. It's like a, this is like a reference implementation. I don't know if you remember these things. I'm sure you remember this. Back in the day when we had things like the Finch and Manor books or stocks.
Woodgrove Bank, man.
Woodgrove Bank.
CMS one, yeah.
This one's pretty cool because what this does is the goal of it is to focus on how a company can use a change feed feature to its advantage to understand user patterns with real-time data analysis and visualization. So it uses, you know, it has dynamic data generation that gets pumped into Cosmos DB. It uses the change feed to check out, you know, what things are actually changing, then pumps those into an Azure function. That's going to pump things over to an event hub, which pumps it over to Azure Stream Analytics, which pumps it over to Power BI. So it's pretty cool. It's a pretty involved lab. I mean, it's got like 8 parts to it that you're going to run through, but it's pretty darn impressive. And you can, you know, scroll through the, see the final output of the stuff that they built. So it's cool stuff, that just a cool resource if you're interested in taking a look at this.
Nice. Nice. Yeah. That's a set of walkthroughs and stuff to get up and running.
Absolutely here.
Raygun provides full-stack error, crash, and performance monitoring for tech teams. Whether you're a software engineer looking to diagnose and resolve issues with greater speed and accuracy, a product manager drowning in bug reports, or you're just concerned you're losing customers to poor quality online experiences, Raygun can provide you with answers. Get full-stack error and performance monitoring in one place. The next time you're struggling to replicate errors and performance issues in your code base, think Raygun. Head over to raygun.com, get up and running within minutes, and dramatically improve your online experiences for your users.
Okay, I got some container news, AC. You know I love containers.
Ooh, let's get boxy.
Two things in particular. Did you say boxy or foxy? Boxy.
I'll let you choose.
Container. Yeah, let's go with boxy. Okay, so the first one is called Announcing the Public Preview of Windows Container Support in Azure App Service. So this is kind of cool. This is about bringing not Linux-based containers, but Windows-based containers to Azure App Service. So you can run your Windows container, and that would obviously help you facilitate things like running .NET code, like ASP.NET code and stuff targeting the .NET framework, you know, for Windows that you haven't migrated to ASP.NET Core and all that sort of stuff. So you could do things like, you know, deploy stuff to the GAC and all that, all those fun, enjoyable things that you know and love. You could do with, you know, Windows containers that you might not be able to rewrite your app for .NET Core or ASP.NET Core or whatever. And this will let you sort of lift and shift those or, you know, deploy onto Windows, but in a container-based kind of environment. So yeah, they go through talking about the SKUs that are available for Windows containers, you know, which images are available to run those and things. But remember, it's in public preview, so it's kind of feedback is warranted.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first one. So Windows containers in Azure App Service. The second one is actually a video more than an article. There's a video that Scott Hanselman did called on Azure Friday that's called Provisioning Kubernetes Clusters on AKS Using HashiCorp Terraform. So we've covered Terraform in the past on the show. We've covered AKS on the show. And now there is a great short-ish video on using the two together and building out your clusters and doing all that sort of stuff with Terraform, with a guest from HashiCorp as well. And they talk through, you know, obviously what it can do and how to use it, some of the benefits and all that sort of stuff. So if you're getting into AKS and want to automate the provisioning of it and all that sort of stuff, then Terraform might be the thing to look at.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so that's containers.
Yeah, that's cool. So I see that you also found something here about an ebook that Microsoft has published.
It's just really a reminder that, you know, there's this thing called the Developer's Guide to Azure that Microsoft make available, and they've done an update to it. So the August update is now available. And you could basically like download the PDF and all that sort of stuff, but it covers things like if you're new to Azure, you know, like the Developer's Guide to Azure, getting started, how to secure your app, building intelligence into your app. And it's basically like a mapping of like, here's the things you might want to do in your application and here's how you do them in Azure. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Some stuff on IoT and deploying Azure services and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, if you're trying to get into Azure and you're listening to our show to kind of come up to speed with some you know, what's available and what's new in Azure, then this ebook might be of useful format to you. You can get an EPUB, you know, so while you're sitting on the beach, you can bore yourself to death with learning all about Azure. I'm only joking. It sounds riveting.
Yeah, that's funny. I took one of those kind of things with me to my beach vacation, and I planned on reading it while I was on my vacation, and it did not get cracked. I did a pretty good job of doing no work on my vacation.
Yeah, I always go in with the best of intentions and end up reading none of it.
Yeah.
So there's the Developer's Guide to Microsoft Azure ebook, if you're interested.
Awesome. I've got a bit of non-Azure-y news. It's from Google Cloud Platform. Over on the Microsoft side, or I guess the Azure or the Visual Studio side, we've got something called Visual Studio Team Services. And that's the it's kind of Microsoft's online code repository solution. It's great. You know, I'm loving VSTS for hosting private projects, and even I'm doing it in a couple of places where we're not even with a couple of teams I'm working with where we're not even hosting code up there, but we're just hosting the process and Kanban boards there, which is pretty cool. But we also have part of VSTS is a whole continuous integration and continuous delivery piece where, you know, when I talked to Donovan Brown last year, he was telling everybody, you know, the first thing you really should try to get into with VSTS is around the release management piece and kind of back your way into it to see what the benefit is there. Well, it looks like Google has kind of jumped into the same boat here, where Google has introduced something called Cloud Build. It's their new CI and CD process. It's a fully managed CI and CD platform that lets you build, test, and deploy software quickly at scale. So this works across a bunch of different environments, including virtual machines, serverless, Kubernetes, as well as their Firebase product. And it also supports Docker containers, giving developers the flexibility to build, test, and deploy in these different automated fashions. So the way that they do it is they offer a free version of Cloud Build, which gives you 120 build minutes per day at no cost, which, I mean, that's pretty
reasonable.
I know when I do a build, hopefully it doesn't take a full minute. So, I mean, if that's going to give me, you know, 120 minutes on a pet project, that's kind of nice.
Yeah.
But you can buy additional build minutes at, let's see if I can get this right. Let's see, it's a 3.5 tenths of a penny per minute. So in US dollars, it's $0.0034 per minute.
So not very much.
Dirt-ish cheap. So what is that?
Man, you'd have to be doing a lot of builds that's per minute. Wow.
Yeah. So to move that over to, you have to 100. So you have to do 100 minutes. You get an additional 100 minutes for $1 a month. For every 100 minutes, it's $1. It looks like that's what they're saying. Is that right?
No, that's a cent.
Right. 1,000 minutes. You get 1,000 minutes.
1,000 minutes to cost $1.
Or $3.
$3. Yes,
yeah.
$3.
So 300 minutes per dollar. We're going to figure this out. We have the math, and we're going to do a new podcast called The Math with CJ and AC.
Sounds like we need some serverless computing with automated builds to figure out what 0.0034 times 1,000 is. Anyway,
That was bad.
A little laggy today. That's cool. I mean, have you tried their build yet? Because there's lots of different build tools. We actually moved to VSTS recently off Travis. So we got completely off Travis now and are all in VSTS for all of our builds, Linux and Windows builds.
I've done a little bit with VSTS builds. I used to use Travis. I also use CircleCI. Man, VSTS is, you know, they needed somebody like Donovan Brown doing this to be able to be pushing this because it's a really good service and it's quickly become my preferred service. The only thing I think that it's not really set up to be friendly in an open source project model. So, but it's really good for like your own internal stuff, your own internal dev stuff and everything. So for me, I'm loving it. And I'm actually even doing stuff that I probably shouldn't be doing with it. Well, not shouldn't be doing, I shouldn't say that. It's stuff that it's not designed to be done with where I'm using it to starting to add pieces to it to help me roll out when I do a new release for my course that I'm working on where it packages and moves all the videos from one place to another one and creates a bunch of output files I can use for the manual pieces that I have to do with some services I use. So
yeah, gotcha.
Cool stuff.
No, it's really cool. And they offer a 5-user for free tier as well, which is kind of nice.
Yeah, it is.
And you get some hosted builds and stuff for free. It's nice.
Absolutely.
Yeah, awesome. Well, that's Google Build, I guess. Is that what Google they're calling
it? Cloud Build. Yeah.
Cloud Build.
I think that's everything we have that's fit for news. You want to have some fun?
Yeah, let's do it.
AC's Voitanos delivers on-demand video-based training for developers on the latest SharePoint extensibility model from Microsoft in his course, Mastering the SharePoint Framework.
CJ's Hyperfish automates the collection of user profile information from users and organizational directories such as Office 365, SharePoint, Active Directory, and HR systems. The secure service supports on-premises, hybrid, and online environments. Bring your directory to life at hyperfish.com.
All right, Mr. CJ, today we're going to run through four picks, that two you got and two that I have. I'll start off. I'll do the first one.
Sure.
This is an interesting link that I found, and I don't want this to come across as a negative thing because it's just a kind of goes along with that LinkedIn article that you talked about earlier. The title of this is it's a blog post that I saw on Hacker News, and it's titled "Where Did the Microsoft Tech Stack Disappear?" So I kind of looked at it and like, oh, that doesn't sound all too great. What it is, there's a website called Stackshare, and it's a website that is going to allow you to search for any tech company and see what their technology stack is. So the example he gives is he searches for Airbnb, and it lists out, here's all the things that we know that Airbnb uses. And you can do that based on the public stuff that, like IPs and looking at the website and looking at the source code, or not the source code so much, but see the output, certain keywords and stuff that are being used. So you can see that Airbnb is using JavaScript, no surprise there. MySQL, React, looks like they're using Nginx for their web server, Redis, Amazon S3, EC2, EBS, ElasticCache, a bunch of stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So what they did is, you know, he went back, he found it kind of interesting. And so he went kind of pivoted a bit and said, let me look at this one list of what they call successful startups. And he looked at the tech stack that was there. And you saw a bunch of stuff listed. And then you saw things like .NET and C++ at about the same amount of usage as Perl and Scala. So things like Ruby are just kicking its butt. And so it kind of surprised this guy. And he's like, hey, you know, I didn't expect this Ruby to be that popular, because he was a .NET developer and he was kind of discouraged, but he saw that all these startups weren't really using things like .NET, C#, ASP.NET, Xamarin, SQL, et cetera.
Yeah.
So he started kind of peeling back that onion a little bit. And he started to kind of say, well, let's take a look and see what some of the big software giants are using. Because, you know, .NET is, we've heard that it's not popular with startups, but maybe enterprises. So let's look at Uber and Dropbox and Shopify. Mm-hmm. So he does that and goes through and looks at it. And you kind of see the same thing, where all these big guys, he looked at, you know, 22 companies, Dropbox, Uber, Stack Overflow, eBay, Shopify, Stripe, PayPal, Netflix, et cetera. Here's the result. .NET and C# is the lowest of all of them by a significant margin. Python, Ruby, Go, Node.js, Java, JavaScript, those are well over three times as much as what .NET and C# is. So it kind of paints a pretty big picture there. And he's like, you know, wonder what the problem is here. Well, then he kind of flips it on his head a little bit, digs a little bit more, and finds out that when you look at, you know, more traditional enterprise companies, people like Microsoft or people like banks and stuff like that, how their tech stacks are much more on the .NET side and much more on what the traditional Microsoft stack is. And, you know, it's not a scientific study here, but I found it kind of interesting. And it just shows, you know, got a lot of things that Microsoft is really trying to, that focuses on. As we talked about earlier, and you saw on the link with the LinkedIn thing, we saw that, you know, Microsoft is really focuses a lot on the enterprise, and they focus less so much on the consumer or the startup space. AWS has done a really good job in that space. So this just kind of shows a little bit more about that. And maybe we started to see new things with Microsoft where, like, their investment in buying GitHub and the recent, you know, release, you know, recent being the last couple of years release of .NET Core, which is much more cross-platform. It kind of shows, you know, with all these other technologies that you looked at a second ago, the one thing that I noticed that was different compared to the Microsoft stack is that all of them are cross-platform. And it really hasn't been until the last 2 years that Microsoft has really started to be a little bit more embracing of the cross-platform stack and coming up with a cross-platform .NET.
Oh, yeah, especially on the dev side of things, right?
Yeah.
You know, the cross-plat dev tools and languages and .NET Core and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, it's only all really come about in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
I'm not surprised by this finding at all. Like, it's kind of funny. I had an interesting experience where I was chatting with a dev who's never really worked in really big corporate environments. And we were talking about C#, and he's like, yeah, like, why would anybody use that ever? Like, that's just not used anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, dude, your head is so far either A, up your own ass, or deep in a hole. and covered in sand that you don't really know what the real world is like in companies. And, you know, we got, I didn't say that to him, but that's what I was thinking. And, you know, it turns out like all of his experience has been sort of on the outward facing, internet facing kind of software side of things, where all these things like Python and Ruby and Go and all of that are far more prevalent. But it really did go to show that a lot of devs that are working in that space really have no clue how the world of corporate software works. Do you know what I mean?
I do. And I think that I wonder, and I'm not saying that this is what's happening, but what I wonder is, and this may not be fair, but it seems to me that the more startup space, the more client-side face, the more like less 9-to-5 corporate developer type, they're more social. They're more social in the sense that they're getting on Reddit. They're having those conversations. They're participating in the surveys. They're looking at stuff that's on GitHub. They're looking at stuff that's on Hacker News and stuff. They're trying out those new languages more, where the more, when I think of a developer, I'm going to really paint with a broad brush here, but if I think of a server-side developer that's working at, you know, a Bank of America or a Citibank or something like that, I don't see that person checking out what the most popular projects are on GitHub or what's going on Hacker News. It's just kind of like the stereotype of just kind of like, I just focus on the tech that's given to me, and that's all that I look at. I don't look at what else is out there.
Yeah, I'd agree with that to a certain extent. I think that's probably the way it is in the vast stereotypical view of it, right? Mm. But I think that's changing too. Like, I wonder if, very slowly, I think, but a lot of those bigger companies, like take T-Mobile here, for example. I've got some friends that work at T-Mobile. They are doing a ton of stuff with open source platforms and tools and all that sort of stuff. Tons and tons and tons. And they're contributing to projects and they're doing all that sort of stuff. And that wouldn't have happened, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, I don't think. But it makes me wonder, like, there are companies like that now, and will we see more and more of that infiltrate companies as developers get more excited about, you know, operating in that space and the projects involved and all that sort of stuff? And that maybe we'll see this become more prevalent in the enterprise as they get more embedded or able to use those tools in their corporate environment, right? And so the story for C# might get even worse unless they nail the open source and outward community stuff better, so that it doesn't ultimately end up losing traction in the enterprise as well as on the internet.
Yeah, and I mean, you're right. I mean, we even look at it from the Microsoft side, and even if you look at Microsoft is the biggest contributor to community projects on GitHub. This has been going on for a while, way before the acquisition of GitHub. But you saw so much of the contributions that were done to Docker, to Kubernetes, were coming from Microsoft to improve Docker and then to make it work for Windows, and the same thing on the Kubernetes side. So those things may be trickling down and trickling out. So I agree with you. There are companies out there that are doing it, and it's a slow transition that's happening. It's just kind of, I kind of look at it as, you know, it took a while for the giant to wake up to open source and to a non-Microsoft world, to a non-Windows world. And
I hope it's not too late.
I hope it's not. I don't think it is. I don't think that we've, like, you know,
I love C#. I really enjoy C#. But anyway, what else you got for us?
So I got a fun one. It's a fun one to me. So last week it was, early August, Elon Musk was at a conference, and I can't remember which one it was, but there's been a rumored project that's been going on since roughly last December. And Elon just said during a call with investors for the last quarterly call, he talked a lot more about it. He's got a project that's been running in a semi-stealth mode for the last 2 or 3 years. And basically, he said that they've been creating the most advanced computer for autonomous operation. So in the past, Tesla has been using NVIDIA chips to power their cars, and the whole like automated driving or the autopilot features and processing the stuff that comes from the sensors and the cameras. And they've done a lot of stuff with it. But the challenge that they've had is that this article by TechCrunch goes into pretty good detail. It's called Tesla says it's dumping NVIDIA chips for a homebrew alternative. What they did is they hired a guy from Apple who was a chip guru to design their next gen AI chips. And the idea is that their software, they've had to make compromises and tweaks to their stuff to be able to get it to run inside of GPUs to take advantage of the AI stuff that they've been needing to do. And in doing so, they've been, number one, dependent upon NVIDIA's releases and NVIDIA's updates, but also they may not be using all of the capabilities in the NVIDIA chips. And so they're not really getting the best density and best bang for their buck. And so they said that Elon did a pretty good job. The guy that they hired, Pete Bannon, he says pretty much everywhere he looked, if someone had a hammer, whether it was a CPU or GPU or whatever, they were adding something to accelerate neural networks, but no one was doing a bottoms-up design from scratch, which is what they do. So what they did is they had the benefit of insight seeing into Tesla's neural networks. And they said, you know, screw it, we're going to build our own computer. And the news that's come out in the last couple of days, we've heard since then, is that the next generation of the autopilot hardware, which is now just the computer, no longer the cameras and the sensors, it's going to be called AP3 or Hardware 3. What that's going to be is just a new computer that has the same connectors that you'll be able to swap out on your existing Tesla, swap out, buy the new computer, have the service center put the new computer in, and you just basically did a huge upgrade to your car for the stuff that they've done. It's kind of cool. It follows a model that, if you're familiar with what SpaceX has done, a lot of times to cut costs, what they've done is they said, you know, we're not going to go buy this off-the-shelf component like Boeing or Northrop Grumman or those other companies use to build their rockets. We're going to build it ourselves. So that's a similar concept to what he's done over here on the Tesla side. And it's pretty cool.
It's cool. Yeah.
Watch it.
I love it how they're doing like a brain swap on a car. It's kind of cool because one of the things that horrifies me about all this, like more and more technology going into things that you own, is that like there's obsolescence almost planned into devices now. And it's nice to see them thinking about like, cool, well, when you go buy a really expensive car, the tech in it is not going to be obsolete a year later, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And, you know, I bet all of those Apple Watch owners with, you know, the rose gold or the solid gold cases or whatever that were like 12 grand or whatever it was, that don't get upgrades, are banging around with an Apple Watch V1 going, wow, this is really awesome. Like, I don't get any of the new stuff in my $12,000 Apple Watch, which, you know, yeah, it's kind of nice that they're thinking about being able to swap stuff out and replace it and upgrade it, which is awesome.
Yeah, it's cool because like now if you bought a car years ago, it sounds like, not entirely sure by this, but what he said on Twitter yesterday, it sounds like you'll be able to drop your credit card, buy the new computer, and have them swap it out for you. But it wasn't really clear if that includes all previous cars. So like I have Autopilot V1 hardware on my car. I don't know if that means that, hey, could I do this if I wanted to? But what is neat is that for new cars that you buy now, they give you an option where you can buy the full self-driving capability and you can pay a certain number now, or you can decide to do it later. But to do it later, you're going to have to pay like almost 2x. Yeah. So you buy it now and say, like, if you bought a car today, next year you could roll in and say, hey, look, they've got the new AP hardware and they'll just swap out the computer for you for the new one.
Pretty cool. It's like upgrading your GPU and your computer. Last time I wanted to swap my GPU out of my computer, I ended up like replacing most of my computer.
Yeah.
because everything needed other stuff. And I think the only thing I ended up not replacing was like the power supply.
And the hard drive, or maybe the hard drive.
The hard drive, yeah. The hard drive stayed, that's true. Yeah, the hard drive stayed, and I think the power supply stayed. So yeah,
That's what's cool about this piece is that he said that, you know, when we're designing it, we're doing the exact same connectors. So you should just be able to swap it out as what our existing computers use. So
that's cool.
I mean, time will tell when they do it. So
nice.
We'll see.
Nice.
How about you? What else you got?
I have a couple of short picks. If you're a traveler and you go to lots of different countries regularly for work and all that, you know how, like, even in the modern age, even if you're on T-Mobile with their free data roaming in 150 countries or whatever it is, you get crappy speed and all that sort of stuff where you roll up in a country. Like, you're going to Norway. What are you going to do about data in Norway? Do you just buy some like roaming package, or what do you do?
So the plan that I have with AT&T is they charge me $10 a day and I basically get a $10 a day surcharge, but I get to use my cell plan the same way I do at home.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is similar to that, right? In that it's called iWi-Fi travel. And they basically give you you rent a puck, you know, like a little Wi-Fi, mobile Wi-Fi puck, but for the country that you're going or the region that you're going in. And so they do stuff like unlimited data and all that sort of stuff. So when you rock up, you just turn this thing on and you're in your bag or your pocket or at your hotel and you're online and you don't have to worry about roaming, you know, mobile roaming charges and all that sort of stuff. And it kind of works. Like if you go into a country where your phone's frequencies aren't right or what have you, it's a great solution to that. It used to be called something else. And actually a mutual friend of ours, Mike Fitzmaurice, originally put me onto this concept years ago. They shut down for a while, but now they're back anyway. So anywhere from like $10 a day to 13 by the looks of it, you can order one of these things for whatever region of the world you're going to and it'll work.
That's pretty cool. So here's the nice thing. So compared to what I was just talking about with what I do, is that same thing for $10 a day. It's not using the battery on my phone.
Yeah.
Access for up to 10 devices, which I mean, I could do that with my, with a hotspot.
Yeah.
But 4G data, which I do have that, but no throttling and unlimited speed.
And not too bad. Yeah. It makes it easier, right? Because your phone isn't burning with the Wi-Fi hotspot on and all that sort of stuff. Anyway, I've used these guys in their previous incarnation and it's pretty cool service. Yep.
That's cool.
Anyway, so they're back. So if you travel a lot, iwifitravel.com. We're not affiliated with them in any way. We don't get any kickbacks for referrals or anything like that either. It's just a cool service. Okay, another article. Final one.
Do they have an affiliate program so we can actually pay for the podcast? They don't.
Bummer. Okay, there's an article here called ISS's, yeah, I don't even know how to pluralize ISS. ISS's retirement may be postponed as US Senate is about to review a bill that prolongs its operation until 2030. So they're talking about funding stuff. There's a bill called the Space Frontier Act, apparently, which aims to prolong the life of ISS by, you know, by funding it for a longer period of time, which obviously sounds great to me.
Yeah.
I think it's got funding up to like 2025 or something like that. And this is talking about, you know, pushing it out beyond that.
I hope they do this.
Me too. It'd suck to see this go backwards.
Yeah, it would really suck to see this. Well, like you said, it really sucked to see this go backwards. To have that kind of an asset and for the benefits that we're actually getting from it. So, I mean, they see the value in this. But when you went to your NASA social that you did, was it an ISS resupply mission or was it something else?
Yeah, it was ISS resupply.
The science briefing is fascinating. The stuff that they're doing up there that applies to what we're doing here on Earth.
Yep. Really amazing. You know, they don't talk about it enough, about the payloads that are going up. Sorry, excuse me, I'm about to cough.
Yeah. CJ's still suffering from this cold that he's got. Yeah, they do a really cool job with this.
So, so it may get funded beyond these things, but, you know, it's politics. So who really knows what'll happen?
Yeah.
But interesting article about it anyway. And you can go read the bill if you want.
Cross our fingers this gets done.
Yeah.
Cool.
Weirdly enough, it's co-sponsored by both a Republican and a Democrat, which is kind of cool. Ted Cruz.
Yeah.
Bill Nelson and Ed Markey. Yeah.
Yeah. The two Florida senators, Ted Cruz, a Republican, Bill Nelson, a Democrat, and a Democrat from Massachusetts.
Florida senator? Ted Cruz is Texas, isn't he?
I'm sorry. Yeah, I just got him confused with Rubio.
Yeah, there you go. Prominent Republican senators anyway.
Yep.
Anyway, hope this passes. We'll keep an eye on it. And then hopefully we won't be keeping an eye on ISS re-entering in 2025.
No kidding.
Yeah. All right, cool, dude, man. That's it for me.
That's it for me too. I think that it's nice to sit down and actually record a show with you again. Hey, but to our listeners, we got cool stuff coming up here. If you're going to be at SP Fest in Seattle, and was that, I guess it's the week of August the
20-something? Yep.
Yeah. So CJ and I will both be there. We actually are going to have two live shows planned for that week. We think there's camera going to be involved as well. So
yep.
Follow the Microsoft Cloud Show on Facebook because we'll stream those via Facebook. We are also, if all things timing goes according to plan, we're also going to have about a bunch of t-shirts to give away at that show as well for listeners. And the order's been placed. They should be here in time. We should be good. But then the other bit of it too that'll be interesting is that we have a whole bunch of additional shirts that we'll have at the Ignite conference, which we have already been confirmed to have a live show there as well.
Yeah, that'd be really cool. I'm looking forward to Ignite. as well. But obviously SP Fest is much sooner, actually, end of the month, 20th, something like that, in Seattle. So if you're attending, definitely come find us. Hyperfish and Live Tiles will be sponsoring the show and are exhibiting there. So I'll be kicking around that booth and obviously the work that we're doing on the show. So definitely come find us and say hi.
Absolutely, yeah. For those of you who are attending the show, we're scheduled to go have a live show at, it appears to be 10:45 on Wednesday the 22nd, and at about 3:45 or 3:50 on Thursday, August the 23rd.
Yeah, awesome.
Very cool.
All right, man.
Looking forward to it.
Absolutely, looking forward to it, and looking forward to hanging out with you, and I'm glad that we're back on our scheduled recordings.
Yeah, definitely. Hopefully, yeah, a little more solid moving forward. Yeah.
Exactly, exactly. Cool, man.
Thanks.
Yep, I will talk to you soon.
Later.
Did you like this episode? Please tweet about it and drop a 5-star review in iTunes. Word of mouth recommendations are the most effective ways for us to grow the show, and we'd really appreciate it. If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text or record it as a WAV or an MP3, and provide a link so that we can play your question on the show. Our theme music is brought to you by Keith Ritchie. For more information on Keith's music, head to music.kritchie.com. You can subscribe to us in iTunes and the Google Play Store by searching for the Microsoft Cloud Show or via RSS at microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll also find notes of each episode. You can also find us on Facebook, searching for Microsoft Cloud Show, or on Twitter, at MS Cloud Show. And finally, sign up to our mailing list by heading over to our website and entering your email to interact with us, participate in upcoming interviews, and other cool stuff. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.